Hi, everyone. My name is Winnie, and I have a pleasure of introducing Dr. James Worry. He is a board-certified dermatology PA and a fellow of the Society of Dermatology Physician Assistants. Dr. Worry holds a doctorate of health sciences from Nova Southeastern University and a master's of physician assistant science from St. Francis University. Since 2011, Dr. Worry has focused his practice on general and surgical dermatology. Outside of the clinic, Dr. Worry serves as an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Health Science, Health and Rehabilitation Sciences, and as president of the Pennsylvania Dermatology PA Society. Additionally, Dr. Worry is a nationally recognized for his dermatology's expertise, serving as a clinical consultant, author, and accomplished speaker. And everyone, let's give him a warm welcome.
That's amazing. I don't get that much excitement at home. I know that for sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you for spending the afternoon with me. I'm really very honored for the privilege to speak to all of you. When I get asked back, I'm just shocked and amazed. So I really appreciate it. It's really something I get excited about. Today, we're going to talk about cutaneous surgery for the dermatology PA. I'm going to tell you a little bit of the things I've learned over the years, some tricks. We'll touch base on something that actually came up in one of the Facebook Derm PA groups, which is the difference between intermediate closure, complex closure. We'll try to clarify that a little bit and answer any questions at the end. So I do have some relationship with industry, but nothing that would compromise or affect today's lecture. So when we are going to perform surgery on a patient, First, we want to start out by preparing for success, is what I call it. And the way that we're going to do that is we're going to start by reviewing our previous notes and what our plan was from before. I very rarely do surgery on a patient the same day as a consultation, unless it's a really serious thing like a suspected melanoma. So in my note, under my plan, I'll say, okay, this is an EIC on the left upper back, it's 3 centimeters, plan excision, complex repair, 3-0 sub-Q, 4-0 suture. That way, when the patient comes back for his or her surgery appointment, the medical assistants can look at the note, they can prepare the patient, have him laying face down and his shirt off so that I don't walk in the room waiting for him to change and flip around, have everything ready to go, and it really streamlines the process. We also want to take a look at our notes because we need to confirm our surgical site. Wrong site procedures are one of the biggest ways you're going to get into trouble in dermatology and dermatologic surgery. It's the leading cause of serious error and injury in dermatology surgery. And you think, what is contributing to the reason why we're operating on the wrong site? And believe it or not, there are things that we do that sometimes contribute to that, and also the patient. The biggest thing is taking too many biopsies. I've seen notes from other clinicians where they've taken 4, 5, 6 shave biopsies all at one time. That's ridiculous. The more you take, you're going to run the risk of mixing them up, mislabeling them, putting them in the wrong bottle, losing one. Also, just practically for business sense, you're not getting reimbursed very well for all those biopsies. So if someone has a lot of dysplastic-looking nevi, you have to prioritize. Find the ones that look most atypical, do a couple biopsies, and work your way through it. It could be more than one visit. It doesn't all have to happen at one time. So my advice to you is only take a couple biopsies at a time. Several biopsies is really setting yourself up for trouble. Document the site from which the biopsy came really well by using fixed anatomical landmarks. So if it's, you know, say at the right superior nasolabial fold, 3 centimeters above the vermilion border, whatever it is, measure and document using an anatomical site that's not going to change. The other thing that you can do, and if it's easy for you with your EMR, would be to photograph the biopsy sites. EMRs like EMMA and some other ones that are made specifically for derm make it really pretty easy to photograph the site. Our EMR is not so hot, but we can still accomplish that, so it can be done. The other thing that I'll do, especially if I'm taking a biopsy on a site like the back where a patient can't see so well, is I try to specifically point it out to the patient, and I put my finger right on the area, and I say, we're taking a biopsy here. And you push on it a little bit, and I think it creates some memory of the spot that you've touched. And then the last thing is that sometimes people do really kind of crazy things. I've even read where people will sort of tattoo an area for the patient. They know that they're going to be sending them out for Mohs surgery or whatever, make some type of permanent indelible mark. A lot of times what I do is if I know a patient is going to need Mohs surgery based on the biopsy and I haven't taken a picture, when I call them to tell them their biopsy results, I ask them to take a selfie of the spot because it may be a month to a month and a half until you see the Mohs surgeon. And if they can take a photograph with them, it helps the surgeon to see the area where he or she will be working. So now we know what we're planning to do. We've got to get to know the patient. And this is what I call the triple A's. So allergies. Are they allergic to anesthetic? Is it a true allergy where they're allergic to lidocaine and epinephrine, or is it just that they get jittery? Latex could be involved, antiseptics, dressings, antibiotics, even suture types. Do they have anxiety? Are they afraid of needles? Are they afraid of doctor's offices? Are they afraid of, I don't know, the color purple? You know, like there are things that people get afraid of, so we want to try to recognize that and kind of quiet that down if we can. And also your patient's attitude. Is the patient on board with the diagnosis, what you plan to do, with you as a PA? There are some patients we know who just don't want to see us. And no matter what we do, even if we do a perfect textbook excision and it turns out well, they might have a bad attitude from the start, and they may think that it's not as good as if a doctor did it. So we want to make sure we have the right patient selected. And if it's a patient with a bad attitude, you don't want to deal with them anyway. So don't worry about that. Let them go. Looking at the patient's history, is he or she on blood thinners? Antithrombotics rarely require discontinuation. But we have to remember, prescriptions can certainly do that. Over-the-counter drugs can do that. Herbal drugs can all impair clotting. There may be some minor increase in intraoperative and postoperative bleeding. However, even though there is a relative risk of increased bleeding, the absolute risk of bleeding is low. That means that continuation of antiplatelet medication is totally acceptable and normal, and it's actually recommended. We do not discontinue antiplatelet medications anymore. But there are things you want to consider. Maybe you do more simple repair. Maybe you don't try to do a giant, large flap or graft. And afterwards, probably want to apply some pressure dressing. So blood thinners now, we really don't think that's a huge deal. I do surgery on patients on blood thinners. Most of the time, they're on blood thinners. And it turns out just fine. The other thing we want to know is about pre-procedure antibiotic prophylaxis. That people's opinions are all over the board on this. I've had attendings who gave antibiotics to every single patient with a joint replacement, and I have attendings who didn't do them at all. But there is a general consensus on pre-procedure antibiotic prophylaxis, and this comes from the American Heart Association, and it's been redefined that patients at greatest risk for post-surgical infection, thereby limiting the use of antibiotics. So the patients that they're saying really need the antibiotics went from this large group to a much more focused. And there is a low risk of significant bacteremia in dermatologic procedures. Our guidelines for antibiotic prophylaxis are not specific to derm. They're extrapolated from the American Dental Association and orthopedic surgeons. If patients are at higher risk for surgical site infections, endocarditis, contamination of a prosthetic joint, they do deserve some special consideration, but just having cardiac issues is not enough to warrant antibiotic prophylaxis. So basically what I have to take away from this is that no antibiotic prophylaxis is required if the repair is uncomplicated, not infected, not on a mucosal site. We were probably overdoing it with the antibiotics before. Getting to know your patient a little bit more, what if he or she has a pacemaker or an implantable cardioverter or defibrillator? Again, when I first started to practice, everyone got the Hyfricator no matter what. And then if you had a defibrillator, we got really freaked out and we didn't use it on them. Now I'm doing it again. So our research is showing us now that electrosurgery is safe and it can be used without causing a problem under certain circumstances. Is it a unipolar or bipolar electrocautery? We want to try to do bipolar. Use short bursts of energy, a low setting, like under 8, 7, 8, low settings and quick burst, and make sure it's at least 15 centimeters away from the device. Some people used to do things like place magnets over the defibrillator to try to shield it. That has been shown to actually cause more problems than not, so we don't need to do that. Just when you hyphurcate, lower level, not too close. And everything turns out just fine for those patients too. We don't see any problem. We know a little bit about the patient. We know what we want to do. So now we need to know what we're going to need. And the first thing is a consent. Informed consent for a procedure is a process in which a healthcare provider will educate the patient about the risks, benefits, alternatives of a given procedure or intervention. It has the nature of the procedure, it has reasonable alternatives, and it has the risks and benefits of those alternatives. Then you have to assess if the patient understands what you've told them. You get a signature, a date, a name, and typically a witness from your assistant. This is a quick photograph of our consent. You can see it's not too involved. It basically says, hey, you have a basal cell. We're proposing that we numb this up with Novocaine and cut it out. These are the risks. These are the benefits. You are going to have a scar. You could go and have Mohs surgery. You could have radiation. There are other alternatives. And if you don't like it, you still have to pay for it. There's some financial disclosure in there as well. Then we send them home with directions. So when I'm doing surgery to kill some time, I chit-chat with the patient, and I say to him or her, you know, you're going to have stitches here for a week. You're going to keep this bandage on until tomorrow, wash it with soap and water, put Vaseline on, new Band-Aid. Then when I leave, the nurse tells them the same directions. Then they give them this printout that we've made. Then the patient throws it away, uses it as a coaster, I don't know, and calls you and says, my spot's red from from Neosporin, or do I leave this Band-Aid on? So even though we go over these directions, and I think it's super important, questions still come up. But sending them home with some directions that they'll hopefully look at in the future is really important. And at the bottom, I tried to put some common questions that we get. So if you had something scraped away with ED&C, yes, you'll see little yellow fibers in there. It's not an infection. Don't put Neosporin on it. Don't put peroxide on it. If you have stitches, you have to get your stitches taken out. Everyone thinks that their stitches are going to magically dissolve somehow. So I had patients show up like 3 weeks later with stitches still in their face, and you think, like, where were you? So we put this in. You know, you're going to have an appointment. You've got to have your stitches taken out, too. So what are we going to need? A medical assistant or a nurse is imperative. Some practices try to short you or rip you off with ancillary staff. It's very dangerous to do procedures by yourself. You may get along fine for a while, but eventually someone is going to bleed, someone is going to pass out, you're going to need something, and you're going to be by yourself. And that's a really scary place to be in when you don't have enough hands. So you should have somebody with you at all times if you're going to be doing procedures. Have a Mayo stand, the hyphurcator, surgical drapes, gauze or cotton tip applicators to blot blood, bandages, tape, etc., and gloves. Recent studies have shown that infection rates are totally unaffected by whether or not you use sterile gloves versus clean gloves. So in our office, I use clean gloves. Some people have a preference for sterile. They are more expensive, and it probably doesn't really make much of a difference, to be honest. And then what else are you going to need? Antiseptic. I like to use alcohol. It's cheap. It's easily available. It kills viruses and bacteria really well. The main concern is that it's flammable, you know, so you want to make sure that the area is totally dry and not saturated in alcohol before you start really going to town with the hyphurcator. But you can also use other things. Iodine stains everything, countertops, clothes, so that's not a favorite. Chlorhexidine. These are other choices. It's up to you. Obviously, we're just trying to clean the surface. But I say good old-fashioned alcohol seems to do a really nice job. And then your instruments. Surgical packs are usually pre-made in the office by the office staff, but they're going to include a blade handle, a blade. 15 is my favorite. Some people like 10 or 20. 11, you know, is very pointy for stabbing abscesses, but not so much for cutting things out. Scissors, which I call sharp scissors, Metzenbaum or Iris, suture scissors, and bandage scissors. My nurses always try to cut suture with tissue scissors. and it dulls them. And then you go to try to remove a little skin tag on somebody's eye and you can't cut through it. So you really should try to use suture scissors when you can. Pickups, needle drivers, suture, which we'll talk on the different kinds, and of course a specimen container to put the little thing that we're gonna remove. There are some dangers or danger zones in dermatology that we need to be aware of. And most of the danger zones are on the face, head, or neck. So that's where I tried to focus some of our attention. We're gonna wanna know where these motor nerves are. Temporal branch of the facial nerve, the marginal mandibular nerve, and the accessory nerve. Encountering these would be a bad time for you and for the patient. This diagram will show you where some of these nerves transverse. Temporal branch, facial nerve, marginal mandibular nerve, and accessory nerve, which is Erb's point. These nerves are typically underneath the muscle. So if you are staying superficial and above the muscle, theoretically you should be in a safe zone, but please know where they crisscross and transverse on the face and neck, and if you are working in that area, either be very sure of your skill in the area and the anatomy, more superficial, and if there's any question, you know, again, this is something that you could refer to a colleague or an attending and let them take on that responsibility. Erb's point is very important. I operate on faces all the time. Particularly old folks, their face heal up so great, they have that extra loose skin. Face is really not so much a big deal. The neck makes me a little bit nervous, particularly if it's in this Erb's point. So in the picture, you can see we're gonna draw a line from the mandibular angle of the jaw to the mastoid and then straight down. This comes to the border of the sternocleidomastoid muscle. Nerves here, spinal accessory nerve, very superficial. Lesser occipital nerve, greater auricular nerve, transverse cranial nerve, and the supraclavicular branches of the cervical plexus. If you disrupt a nerve here, and they are superficial and really close to the top of the muscle, specifically the spinal accessory nerve, that could result in winging of the scapula, which is a permanent problem. So this is one of the few areas where I do not like to operate. Not only do we have motor nerves, of course, we have sensory nerves. These are more superficial, not as big of a deal, but still a problem. And we have greater auricular, supraorbital, and supratrochlear. Disruption of these can cause temporary paresthesias, neuralgias, and things like this. It's rare for them to be permanent, but it is a possibility. And this is the way that they come out of the skull and the facial bones and transverse onto the skin. And that leaves us with vascular danger zones. So the head and neck is obviously a very vascular area. It heals really well. But if you are operating on the head, neck, or scalp, plan for some bleeding. Bring extra gauze. Maybe have a set of hemostats available. Have the hyphricator. Know that you may encounter that bleeding. It may not happen. But if it were to happen, this is the area where it would. Areas with tenuous blood supply, like the fingers or the toes, are perfectly fine and safe to use epinephrine. Some people will not use epinephrine, but studies have shown that it is perfectly fine to use epinephrine in these locations under the certain circumstances. It's diluted at least 1 to 200,000 or greater. The volume is less than 3 cc's total. A ring block is avoided, so if you're doing a finger, you wouldn't want to go circumferentially around the whole way. And if a patient has vascular compromise, you avoid that. Atherosclerosis, Buerger's, Raynaud's, any vascular compromise, you may want to avoid epinephrine, particularly in digits or tenuous places. What do you do with troublemakers? Well, surgery over the joint can be problematic. It can limit mobility. People can move their limbs too much and rip out their stitches or make their scar wide. And then some folks are prone to keloids or hypertrophic scarring. The difference is respect to the boundaries of the incision or the trauma. So a keloid will go beyond the boundaries of the trauma, but they're pretty much the same thing. Joints in bendy areas and dehiscence is really probably the most problematic. If you have a patient in whom you know they are most likely to keloid or have a history of keloiding, many times what I'll do is try to use Steri-Strips to reinforce it, and I'll also inject Kenalog at the time of surgery and then also at their suture removal to try to prevent the keloid from happening. Advanced suturing techniques can also be helpful in ways that you want to try to disperse the tension. So you can use things like mattress sutures that are going to help to spread out the tension. Here's a patient who had surgery over the joint. We used three mattress sutures to try to avert the edges really well and disperse the tension over the shoulder. And then you set the scene. So you're going to make sure you have good overhead lighting so that you can see what you're doing. Spotlighting, also helpful. You want to have the surgical table at the appropriate height so that you're not stooping over and hurting your back. And then you want to have the ambience. We have Sonos system in the office, so I pick the tunes every day, and we jam every day, listen to music, chit-chat about what they're doing with the rest of the day. Are they going to go to lunch? You know, how's your family doing? And joke around a little bit. I always try to joke with the patients and have a good time. And it really helps to take their mind off of what's going on and makes the procedure pass quickly. One of the Google reviews that we got basically said that patient came in for a procedure, we started to talk about her job, what she's doing, and before she knew it, it was totally over. So I think that the patients do appreciate that time with you and chatting with them, and it helps to take their mind off of what's going on. So we're going to talk about our anesthesias next. And the local anesthetics, the mechanism of action is that it's going to block the membrane from the sodium-potassium channel. It slows the conduction of C and A-type nerve fibers. And we have to know that there could be some potential side effects of the medication. Vasovagal response we see happen from time to time. Patient gets nervous, they tense up, they're not breathing well, and that can cause hypotension, bradycardia, and sometimes they have a syncopal episode. Bruising or edema from the injection sites. Transient or temporary motor nerve paralysis. Or prolonged paresthesia. Sometimes the nerves can go to sleep for hours and hours and not want to come back online. And then allergy. A true allergy to local anesthetic is rare. And the ester group is more likely to have an allergy than the amide group. Keep in mind that this would be a true allergy. It's a type 1 allergic reaction. It's severe. It's urticaria. It's angioedema. It's anaphylaxis. This is not, I get nervous, my heart races, I'm jittery when I have lidocaine, epinephrine. This is, oh my God, you're having a full-on allergic reaction right now. The ester-based group includes procaine, tetracaine, chlorpheniramine. Amide-based group, lidocaine, bupivacaine, mepivacaine, and ropivacaine. A quick, easy way to remember it, the amides have two eyes. Lidocaine is certainly going to be the one that we see used most often, which is apparently on back order, so I've been hoarding it at the office. Every time we order supplies, I get a few extra. But I've heard and read that lidocaine is hard to come by right now. 1% with 1 to 100,000 epi, most common. We like this because it has a rapid onset. Its duration is 1 to 4 hours, which is perfect for derm procedures. Nothing should be taking over, you know, an hour that we're doing, or certainly 4 hours. And the toxicity rate is low. So basically, patients can handle more lidocaine with epinephrine than without. And that's because the constriction of the blood vessels slows the metabolism and decreases the diffusion of the epinephrine and the drug. The maximum dose of epi is 7 mg/kg, and the maximum dose without is 5 mg/kg. The first sign that you can have a lidocaine intoxicity is circumoral numbness and tingling. This is very unusual to happen with the amounts of lidocaine that we use for local excisions. We see this most commonly, and where it has become a problem is in providers doing tumescent liposuction in the office. That's where the number one problem with lidocaine intoxicity is occurring, and they're giving these patients too much. So, what we're going to talk about next is epinephrine. We know epinephrine is important to help get the job done, and it also helps to make the lidocaine last longer. It's going to prolong your anesthesia by 100 to 150%. Specific side effects can occur, and they may include palpitation, anxiety, headache, or arrhythmias. Sometimes patients are truly allergic to lidocaine, and you're like, oh man, what are we going to do now? This is where you can use some of these alternatives. Diphenhydramine or injectable Benadryl can be used. I do use this from time to time. I think it is most useful in a shave biopsy situation. I have tried it for an excision. It's not the most comfortable thing in the world, but it does take the edge off. For shaves, my suggestion is to inject it, raise a wheel, and work really quickly. But if you do that by the same means, you can also use normal saline to do a shave. The distension of the tissue, if you get it to blanch and become a weal, will also numb the area. Or you could lightly freeze it with liquid nitrogen and then do a little biopsy. But if it's true that a patient cannot tolerate any anesthetic of the esters or the amides and they needed an excision, it may be a little bit of a challenge and they may be someone whom you would refer out. So we're going to numb the area. Typically what I'm going to do is a field block. So a small gauge needle, like a 30, bevel up, and then do a field block all around the lesion that you're wanting to excise. This creates a really great broad area of anesthesia. You could do digital blocks on the fingers or the toes. And basically what you're going to want to do here is to block the dorsal and the palmar digital nerves on the top and the bottom. Advance the needle until you feel bone. Back up a little bit, aspirate, inject your lidocaine top and bottom. I also then typically take a 4x4 gauze, open it up, tie it around the finger as a tourniquet, and let the patient let their hand dangle for a minute. And that really helps to constrict the blood vessels and let it soak in pretty nicely. And then there are some specialized nerve blocks. Particularly, we see these for facial surgeries. And you may do dental blocks or facial nerve blocks, depending upon how big of an area you're working on the face. So now to get to the real meat and potatoes of it, the excision, prepping the site. Again, I think alcohol is an easy way to go. You want to measure the lesion itself that you're removing, the addition of your margins, and then the way you're going to turn it into an ellipse, orienting the incision along the skin tension lines the best that you can. Okay, so then what we're going to do, you'll see in the picture, in the skin tension lines, the little dotted area is the lesion, the circle solid is the margins, and then the little triangles turning it into an ellipse. Okay. Perfect. And then what I call the first cut is the deepest. So we're going to use the belly of your blade, typically 15, make the clean cut, use your pickups, lift up the specimen, and then undermine around it. Some people like to use scissors to undermine in more of a blunt fashion. I like to use the blade to undermine. I think it goes through a little bit smoother, but there is also the risk that if you slip or there's a lot of tension, you're gonna make a little additional nick in the skin. And hemostasis, you wanna try to ensure that the area is dry prior to closing it. Let's see, should have a little video here. Do I have to do anything special to make the video play? There we go. So we have an excision here on the nose that's been speed up a little bit. So we're gonna make our first incisions using the belly of the knife. Got it into an ellipse now. Tease it away. Okay, and that's my nurse Maria making her debut, the black gloves. And now we're gonna take a look and see if there's bleeding. I typically see if there's oozing, it's typically like an aspirin or a blood thinner. It can be a little bit difficult to see where it's coming from. Hyphurcation works great, but you know it has to be dry. One of my tricks is that I try to use the gauze on the tip of the hyphurcator to kind of dry and hyphurcate at the same time, and that can work really well. The other things that you can do would be to use pickups to grasp an area and then hyphurcate the pickups or hyphurcate a hemostat. But we want to try to make sure that the area is dry before the sutures go in. Another trick that I'll show you here is that sometimes you just need to add a little bit more epinephrine. A little bit more epi can help to squeeze any little oozing blood vessels, and that can certainly help to control the bleeding. Now for our undermining, here we're going to use the blade. And we just want to free up the edges so that we can get a nice local advancement flap and that free moving skin over top. People will sometimes use sharp scissors here as well, but I like to use the blade. And now it's time for sutures. So we're going to put in our sub-Q sutures. And here we're going to use a 4-0 suture sub-Q, and then we use 5-0 nylon on top. Approximate the edges the best that we can. The sub-Q sutures should be doing most of the work and holding most of the tension. Maria's using scissors, tissue scissors to cut the suture just like I like. This is where I would chit-chat. What are you doing today? You gone to lunch? What are you getting your dad for Father's Day? And now we have it closed up, and we're going to just use some nylon sutures to reinforce the surface of it. I'll tell the patient, you have stitches underneath your skin. They're the ones doing the majority of the work. You have some stitches on the surface. Those are the ones that we're going to have to remove in 5, 7 days, whatever. So that's a little brief overview on what the surgery is looking like. We go to the next one. Thank you. So suture. Picking your right suture is very important for a successful repair. And the things that we need to think about: tensile strength, configuration, elasticity, and memory of suture. Tensile strength basically means how much ability the suture has to resist breakage. Configuration, is it a monofilament, one string, which is good for reducing infection, but harder to tie, or is it a braided suture? Braided suture tends to hold on to bacteria a little more, so infection rate can be a bit higher, but it is easier to tie. The elasticity is how much does it stretch or give and then return to its shape. And the memory is, does it maintain its shape? There are, of course, absorbable sutures. Gut suture, which is probably the oldest type of suture, has a very high tissue reactive and allergy rate. But there's other brands or types like Vicryl, Maxon, or Monocryl. And then there's, of course, non-absorbable suture. These go on top. They're nylons, and they can be ethicon or proline. So picking the right size suture now, which O is right for which location? The smaller the number, the thicker or stronger the suture. 3-0 is great for areas under tension, and this can include back, joints, or muscular regions. 6 is great for eyelids and delicate areas, and 4-0 is an all-around great O. And how long do we leave these in? This is always the first question patients want to know. How many stitches am I going to have, and how long are they going to be there? So this little chart gives you a bit of a breakdown, and you can see basically the more superior, of course, the less time, inferior things can be much longer. Suture styles, well, they're simple interrupted. This is a little bit time consuming, but it has a really great accurate skin approximation. Simple running is fast, has good approximation, but we know the problem is that this will totally unravel. So if a patient goes out and is crazy and plays baseball or goes bowling like everybody wants to do right after you operate on them, if they pull out one, the whole thing is going to go. Or sometimes I get really excited and I'm at the end of the surgery and I go to do my last couple and I pull too hard and I rip the needle off. Then you have to kind of back it up and tie it and start with a new pack. So running can save you time or it can cause you a lot of problems. I suggest running on areas where you have no tension at all if it's possible. And then we look into some specialties. I oftentimes will use vertical mattress or horizontal mattress. Vertical mattress and horizontal both take some extra time, but they give you good wound aversion, and they can also help to cut down on widening scars or enlarged scars. So we see here suture styles, and on the left is a simple interrupted. On the right is a run-in. And then we have the mattress sutures. On the left, we have vertical mattress, and on the right, horizontal. Vertical, people sometimes say far, far, near, near, but this way of putting in mattress sutures is really helpful for distributing tension. These can also be used sub-Q as retention sutures, which is helpful when you're looking at the type of repair complexity that you're going to be billing. So let's talk about the repairs because this comes up quite a lot. A simple repair is just what it sounds like. This is included in your fee for a punch biopsy or for a simple excision. It's a simple repair and it's included in that charge. It doesn't get its own separate identifiable charge. Then we come to intermediate. So an intermediate repair of a wound is that in which in addition to the simple repair, it requires a layered closure. It has limited undermining, a distance that is less than the maximum width of the defect measured perpendicular to the closure line along at least one edge of the defect. We'll compare this with complex. And complex includes what's required for an intermediate and something else, one of the following. Exposure of the bone, hope not, cartilage, tendon, or named neurovascular structure, debridement of a wound, extensive undermining. This is where we probably all try to get the complex closure. Extensive undermining is defined as a distance equal to or greater than the maximum width of the defect measured perpendicular to the closure line along at least one entire edge of the defect, or involvement of a free margin of the helical rim, vermilion, or nostril. So for just the easiness of math, if you have a 1 centimeter defect, you need to undermine at least 1 centimeter, 1.1 larger, on one whole side. If you undermine 0.5 on the other side, that's cool too. But if you did 0.5 and 0.5 on each side, that's not complex. It's one on an entire side. So sometimes we have complications. This happens. This is part of the job. We're ready for it. It may throw you off. It may take some extra time, but it should be something we can handle. And bleeding is the one that we're all most concerned about. You have to stay calm. Remember, you're in charge. It's your place. You're the one who's setting the tone. And if you freak out, the medical assistant's going to freak out. The patient's going to freak out. So just take a breath and remember what we've all been told. All bleeding stops eventually. So stay calm. Don't worry. It'll be all right. One time I had a nurse, Michelle, who was new with me, and I was operating on this guy's back, and he was bleeding a lot, like onto the floor a lot. And she said, are they supposed to bleed that much? So just, you know, give them the look, let them know it'll be okay, stay calm. I find that oozing from blood thinners tends to be nonspecific, and it is sometimes difficult to address. Spurting or a little arterial bleeding actually tends to be a bit easier. So what do you do when someone starts to bleed? You want to make sure you get more gauze, cotton tip applicators, things to blot. Hold direct pressure onto the incision site, and I like to have my assistants hold indirect pressure around it in case there are some blood vessels coming in at an angle. The other thing that you can do is that if it is a little spurting blood vessel, you can use hemostats and clamp it and leave them on for a couple minutes. I typically will clamp something, leave the patient with the assistant, and go see somebody else and come back after 5 minutes or so. And oftentimes the vessel will spasm and stop on its own. You could ligate or suture tie the vessel and then cut the little tails down very short because they're going to stay buried. And you can hyphurcate. You could do the trick with the hyphurcation, directly hyphurcate the area, or use a gauze and try to hyphurcate. You can pick up an area that's bleeding with hemostats and hyphurcate the hemostats or the pickups. That also can be helpful. You can add some additional lidocaine and epinephrine, and you can wait a few minutes. Bleeding will typically slow if you just wait it out a little bit with some of those interventions. But occasionally the bleeding does happen, and it looks dry, but you close it up, you sit the patient up, and then they have a big goose egg and a lump in the area, and you realize that they have developed a hematoma and some bleeding underneath the skin. If it's small, it oftentimes will just enlarge until it pushes pressure and tamponades on its own. If it's relatively large, then unfortunately you probably have to open that up again, try to identify that site of the bleeding, cauterize it, ligate it or whatever, and then close it up. Hematomas take a long time to absorb or reabsorb, especially in larger ones. It could be weeks. There is a higher chance of an infection with a hematoma, so this is a time in which you may want to consider giving the patient antibiotics to help with that. An infection, exceedingly rare in dermatologic surgeries, luckily. 0.4 to 2.5% of infections will get, surgeries will become infected. Topical antibiotics show no advantage to plain petrolatum in the prevention of infection. So postoperative antibiotic prophylaxis is not routinely recommended anymore in dermatologic surgeries. The most common time for infection is 4 to 10 days postoperatively, and risk factors for infection include diabetes, obesity, smoking, contamination of the wound, anticoagulation, or advanced age. Ways in which you can try to prevent surgery or infection during your surgery is to have shorter surgery times, straightforward repairs, clear and clean techniques, and change the dressing within the first 12 hours to 24 hours of surgery. You know infection when you see it. You have a purulent discharge. You can culture it and isolate an organism. There may be tenderness, edema, or erythema. Treatment empirically with antibiotic coverage against Staph aureus, Streptococcus pyogenes, with cephalexins such as Keflex. If you have a high suspicion for MRSA, doxycycline, clindamycin, or Bactrim can be helpful. Pain, very rarely do I deal with any complaints of pain in surgery. Do lots of surgeries, old folks, they take it just fine. Occasionally you get somebody who seems to be a little wimpy or wants pain medicine, but that's very unusual. NSAIDs and acetaminophen should be first line. The day of surgery is associated with the greatest discomfort, and that is usually minimal in and of itself. Certainly by day 4 post-op, pain should be minimal. Severe pain is atypical, and if someone is complaining of severe pain, it should prompt an investigation as to, do they have an infection? Do they have a hematoma? Is something else going on? This pain is out of proportion. And opioid use is rarely needed. I don't have a DEA. I've never needed it. And I think it just avoids the whole issue altogether. But we know patients who have a lot of anxiety may experience pain a little bit differently. And we'll wrap up with a few other complications. Irritant dermatitis, the perfect Band-Aid. When people ripping it off the same spot, I tell them to wear it up and down, side to side, crisscross, whatever. And then our best friend, Neosporin. 10 to 20% of people have an allergy to neomycin, and in 2010, it was allergen of the year. Patients love Neosporin. We all know this. They're still going to do it, and they're still going to call you and tell you that it's red and bother you. So whenever somebody tells me that their wound is infected, I usually get kind of like mad first. I'm like, what are you putting on it? And it's Neosporin. I'm like, see, told you. And then dehiscence. This happens. It doesn't mean you did anything wrong. Sometimes people don't listen. Sometimes you're just finishing the surgery and they're like, oh, by the way, I'm a lumberjack or something, you know, and they're going to go to work and rip out their stitches. So we want to try to prevent dehiscence in the ways we've talked about, but it happens. If it's had a wound dehiscence, you want to see, have the sub-Q sutures also been ripped out or are they still in place? So is it complete or partial dehiscence? And when are you finding out about it? If they say, hey, my wound just dehisced, and you say, okay, come right in, then some people will resuture it. I do that from time to time. I typically freshen up the edges by curetting them or cutting them with scissors so that it's bleeding a little bit. I think it does better. But if it's been really a complete dehiscence or a long time, then secondary intention is going to be the way to go. And lastly, specimen handling. 75% of specimen mishandling errors occur in the pre-analytic phase. That's the way of saying in your office. So you've done something, unfortunately. Mislabeled them is number one. Switch them, number two. So mislabeling specimens or misplacing specimens is where the majority of the problems happen. Label your bottles immediately, name, location, date of birth, and make sure it matches the requisition. If you have a small specimen, write on the requisition to warn the lab. And the PA and the MA should visualize the specimen in the bottle, combine the bottle and the requisition demographics, and place in an individual sealed bag. Maintain a log of your biopsies, what you have sent out, on what patient, what date, to what lab, what you're looking for, and then have a column for when it comes back. That's the way that I handle it. And that way it helps me to keep track and to close the loop as far as when things are going out and when things are coming back. And occasionally, you know, we miss something coming back by fax or EMR, and after a week or so I notice that that little row is still empty. We'll call the lab and have it sent over. Review your pathology, make contact with the patient, document it in the EMR, and make sure that you have a plan that's set into motion that you can follow through with. These are works cited. This is my email, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, Brittany, take it easy on me.
I have a question if you've used like the HemiGuard or the suture guard in like high tension areas.
No, I don't have any experience with them. They are cool, fancy, probably expensive, which is why we don't have them. But I don't. Have you guys used them? Brittany does Mohs surgery.
We do use them. Not as much the suture guard, but the HemiGuard. Can be helpful in like areas that are really tight, sometimes like on the calf, or if some of their skin is just really tight. But you can bill for a complex closure if you use those.
The HemiGuard, cool. Yeah, definitely something to look into. Thank you. We don't have those fancy things at the Gola Center, Brittany. Hello.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Do you give prophylactic antibiotics for Mohs repairs involving the mucosa of the lip?
Mucosa is a special area to consider, and in a patient at risk, that would be an area where you could do antibiotic prophylaxis, yes. In a non-at-risk patient or average risk, you would not.
What antibiotic do you prefer and what dose?
You know, sometimes we don't do Mohs surgery, Brittany, but sometimes in Mohs surgery they do antibiotics mixed in with their, what do you use? Cefadroxil, Keflex. You give it to everyone? Gotcha. Okay, so cefadroxil or cefalexin sound like the key for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Brittany.
Thanks, Dr. Worry.
My pleasure.
What strength of Kenalog do you use to prevent hypertrophic scarring?
So if I look at the patient, they've had a lot of other keloids and they're pretty pronounced, I will go for 10, straight up 10. I would say between 5 and 10, depending on the area. Chest, definitely 10. Face, I'll go a little bit less. But I really think the intraoperative Kenalog and then Kenalog at suture removal makes a huge difference. That's the way to go.
Do you use the same strength then at suture removal?
Yes.
As well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep, my pleasure. Thank you.